You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is The Comedian's Comedian. And today I am very pleased to bring you this conversation with Mike Birbiglia, who is someone I've been trying to get onto the show for years and years and years. I was thrilled to spend some time with him. I'm so grateful to him for making time in his astonishingly busy creative life. We spoke in his studio from in a little corner of his studio from where he produces his fantastic Working It Out podcast, which has recently celebrated episode 100 with his frequent collaborator Ira Glass of This American Life fame. We are going to talk about everything. We're going to talk about there's lots and lots of process stuff. I nearly called him Birbigs there. His website is Birbigs. I don't know that I'm on Birbigs terms with him. But Mike is coming to Edinburgh for the very first time with his smash hit new show, The Old Man and the Pool, which I have seen. And it is just, I mean, it's brilliant. And it's just as good as all of his other brilliant, brilliant shows. We're going to talk about the minutiae of his creative process, from the rhythms of his jokes and his very deft and subtle use of things like implication and letting the audience catch up with you, and the sort of narrative combination of storytelling and jokes. And there's a section we talk about writing sort of the equivalent of one-liners, like narrative one-liners. And we're gonna talk about the glue in between the bits and find out why he is only beholden to the owner of the circus. And he brought that up. So we're going to get stuck into that in just a second. There are 30 extra minutes available to you. I would say unmissable minutes. If you're a member of the Insiders Club, which includes a fascinating example, an anecdotal example of the application of the Jimmy Carr brain to the Mike Birbiglia sentiment. I'll leave it there. If you're interested in that, you should definitely get to the extras. We'll talk about the codification of the language in his shows. And also he tells us how to get the best feedback out of one Daniel Kitson. So all of that is available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, where you can also find ad-free episodes, all the extras from every show that has them, and much, much more, including special exclusive Insiders Q&As that we had on Zoom, plus the incredible Self-Help for Comedians special with Amanda Donnett. So go nuts. You get to support the podcast with a minimum £2 a month donation, or as much more than that as you like. And without further ado, here at long last is the wonderful Mike Birbiglia.
Well, what's funny is I don't view myself as in the movie industry proper. I just make all of my shows, even the show I'm bringing to London, like The Old Man in the Pool. These are all self-produced shows. I mean, The Old Man in the Pool is my fifth show. Don't Think Twice was my second movie. Sleepwalk With Me was my first movie. All of these were independently financed, outside of some kind of larger system. And then along the way, some of them more than others have made their way into mainstream venues. Like with Old Man in the Pool, we ended up at Lincoln Center. Honestly, a total fluke, because it just so happened that Camelot, the adaptation by Aaron Sorkin, was going in there and it wasn't ready yet. And so they held it until the winter. So they had like an open 12 weeks. So we ended up at Lincoln Center in the Vivian Beaumont Theater, one of the most gorgeous theaters imaginable. And even like when I'm in London, I'm at the Wyndham's, which is like one of the most gorgeous theaters in the world. but it's not. I don't think it's because of I'm on the inside. I certainly am not on the inside. Yeah, so I'm for it is what my long answer, my question, question.
I wonder what that means. I wonder what being on the inside means anymore. Is it the case that you, as someone who, like, you achieve a certain amount of success, you command a certain audience, you're critically acclaimed, those kind of things. Do you think, is there some point at which you will pass through a membrane and be on the inside? Or do you think maybe the reverse is true, that no one feels like they're on the inside and there is no inside?
I think no one feels like they're on the inside. At least that's my experience. There's only a handful of people where, like, I worked with Tom Hanks recently on A Man Called Otto, and he was so nice. He's just beyond generous and treats everyone in the cast and crew so well. But I think he knows. Like, he's one of the only people I've met who, and Nathan Lane is like this too. I think they know that they're states people. You know what I mean? That they've been in the business long enough that they need to almost be an ambassador for show business.
Can you see yourself becoming a statesperson? I feel like you have a kind of statesperson role within comedy.
I don't know. I mean, it's funny. I was talking to Liz Kingsman the other day on my podcast here, and I said, so I'm bringing the old man in the pool to London. We'll see how that goes. And she was like, no, people are very excited. and I go, I think it's maybe just comedians. I don't think people in England know who I am or what I do.
No, you have Netflix specials.
Yeah, do people watch American Netflix comedy specials there? I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, certainly everyone I speak to, yeah. I'm a comedian. I'm in the comedy world. You're known and respected, and I have to say, I asked for some podcast listener questions in the Facebook group associated with our podcast, and I got. The response was very large, but it was also notable how intelligent the questions were. I feel like you are known amongst the kind of the comedy fans.
That's so nice to hear, and I'm curious what those questions are. But also, like, I always say that I don't have the most fans, but I have the funniest fans. Like, when I did a photo of Liz Kingsman was here in my studio, and I took a photo of her dog. Talking into the microphone on the other end and me on the other side. And I just wrote caption this in my Instagram. And there's like 300 replies, and they're really good. They're like as good as I would write for that thing. So yeah, I have funny fans, which is a blessing.
So with regard to your kind of your sense of yourself and whether or not you're kind of, you have a statesperson role within comedy and maybe a role that is not quite so kind of ground in yet in the wider world of showbiz. When you're coming to Edinburgh, this is the first time you're performing at Edinburgh, is that right? I can't
shocking.
Believe it.
Yeah, no, it's
shocking. You've been there before?
No, I've never been to Scotland at all. And I've always wanted to go, and I've always, you know, all of my British associates, Jimmy Carr and Daniel Kitson and all these folks have said to me for years, like, they're like, your shows are Edinburgh shows.
100%.
So like, why aren't you going to Edinburgh? And I'll basically always say, like, because I want to go, but it's like a huge loss financially.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's so, why they want you down the crabs in the bucket. I'm like, come on, Mike, come to Edinburgh. Taste the pain.
I don't think civilians, your casual comedy observers, realize that when all these performers show up, that they're all like taking a bath to be there. You know, so I've had my daughter's eight, so I have to pay the bills. So I've always like, I don't know. And it's never quite worked out, but now it's going to work out. It's, you know, we made it work and so I'm thrilled. I mean, I hope that it's the beginning of I bring all my shows to Edinburgh from now on. I really hope that's the case.
And what will determine that?
Honestly, it's really just seeing what kind of a life I can live there for a week. Like, for example, like I started coming to Playing London because years ago, the Soho Theater asked me to do My Girlfriend's Boyfriend in probably 2011 or something like that. And I said, I'll give it a try. And then I rented an Airbnb and I was like, I just fell in love with London. And I was like, oh my gosh, I want to visit here all the time. And so I think I've brought every single show since then. It really comes down to like, can you find your way? I think sometimes people don't realize with touring performers that some of it comes down to like, how much can they enjoy their lives while they're in the places where they're doing their shows? Like last summer I went to Iceland and Paris and London, and that was a thrill. Cause that's like, oh my gosh, I get to bring my 8-year-old daughter to Iceland. And also there's a beautiful performance space there. So that's like a great, great experience.
And you're of a kind of maturity, a seniority within the comedy world now, that you get to travel with family, that you get to go to places for decent lengths of runs, that there is, do you know what I mean? Like the touring comic you, I recently rewatched Sleepwalk With Me with like the you know, the fictionalized version of starting out in comedy, and those Google Map, we all remember, of like, you know, these enormous journeys and what have you. And it was, I was watching that feeling just kind of bittersweet, thinking if I'd seen that movie when I was 20, before I'd ever started out in comedy, I would feel irresistibly pulled towards it. I've been like, God, I have to do this. And it's so funny now to look back at those kind of, that very well depicted, very richly, that very evocative kind of depiction of what it's like starting out in comedy, and to be able to look at it and go, oh, I have bittersweet memories of those times.
No, completely. And it's like, it's that thing of like the character in the movie, the character I play in the movie, it goes to, checks into a hotel for the first time. It's this junky hotel, but he's like jumping on the bed and using all the towels and all this kind of thing. And I think, honestly, when I look back on that period, it's just like the reason why it brought me joy at the time is just freedom. It's just the idea of like there's no rules. Like even when you go to university or whatever, it's like you have a sense of like there's still rules. Like your parents are gone, but like you still have to abide by some kind of decorum. I think if you travel as a comedian or an artist, like it really is the circus. It really is kind of like I'm only beholden to the circus owner.
And how does that, how do you feel now with regard to the amount of rules that there now are in stand-up comedy as you perceive it? Now, I mean, like the first most obvious one is you're a dad.
Yeah.
You're a dad in your mid-40s, as am I.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly confronted with a lot of like, oh, loads of the things that made this job brilliant are now all the things that make it really tough.
But what, you know what I mean? For like, example, what?
Oh, well, like the being away from home.
Oh, yeah, it's awful. It's awful.
It's just awful. And you think, oh, surely there's a point at which you can become like senior manager level in your own career where you no longer have to go on the road. You're like, no, you still have to.
No, that's absolutely true. And I've ended up booking myself lately in New Jersey and Long Island and all these places that are like a 2-hour, 3-hour drive from New York so that I can see my daughter every day because she's 8. And it's that thing where your child is 8 and you're like, oh, I'm going to miss everything. And I wrote this joke the other day about how might be my next show, I don't know, but how when my daughter's 8 and it's an amazing age, but I'm incapable of living in the present. So my brain goes to when she's 16 and she's going to be like, my dad is garbage, you know? And that's the natural progression of life, right? Like that's how things are supposed to go. But my dad didn't have to deal with that because when I was growing up, people just disregarded their children. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like they, like we said it and my dad would be like, is someone talking, you know? but now I have to be like, she'll be like, she'll be like, my dad is garbage. And I'll have to be like, she's so right. I am garbage. She's so brave. I'm so proud of her. How can I amplify her voice? And I feel like that's sort of the funny conundrum of modern parenting right now is that the gold standard is just sort of yes-anding everything your children say.
Yes. So with regard to that, and I didn't ask you to lead to this question, but just with the idea of like a new joke or like I've got a thing I've been thinking about.
Yeah.
Can we just kind of dig into what it is that because that's a really you kind of a bit, right?
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
like
sure.
That has wisdom in it and it has wit in it, and it's also you're kind of exploring these ambiguities and kind of making it relatable as well, I guess, to people who don't have children. You've kind of expanded it enough, and I'm like, oh look, the creation of a Mike Birbiglia bit, you know. So what does it feel like from the inside, like when you have that and you go, there's something in this? Like, what are the aerials that are kind of what are the lights on the dashboard that are blinking that you go, I can do something with that?
I think that one came out of a consistent question that people would ask me, is like, how do you like being a dad? And then I think, well, now it's great. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like a lot of times in your life, it's like, as a comedian, you're just clocking, what are the consistent questions being asked of you, and what consistent questions are you asking of the world? And then taking one apart and just breaking it apart and dissecting it. So I'm going like, she's 8, which is fantastic. And there's nothing funny about fantastic, right? that's
I'm going to get on stage and tell everyone how much I love my family.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing humorous about contentment at all. And so then it's like, well, what's discontent about that? Well, what's discontent is that I flash forward to when she's twice the age she is now. And then my dad is garbage. And then I'm like, for me, that's when it starts to be a joke, because I'm like, oh, what's funny about that is actually that I will support that. That's how much I love my daughter. I will support that idea. I'll try to amplify it. And then I'm like, oh, okay, I'll try that on stage. I'll bring that to the Comedy Cellar down the street here, which is the equivalent of your, I think, the store.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'll try it. And if there's a connection between me and an audience, I'll go, oh, okay. There's something there. There's the Venn diagram of what I think is funny about having a child and what the audience thinks is funny about having a child has a big enough cross section that it's worth exploring. And so I'll do it again, and I'll try to pair it with like 5 other observations about parenting and see if I can create like a 5-minute chunk. And then hopefully the 5-minute chunk becomes like a single story. Like a lot of times I'll fudge the chronology of it to arrive at something that has a continuous causal 5-minute exploration. Like, for example, I have another joke right now I've been telling about how my wife and I took Una to her ballet recital the other day, and we're in the audience, and we're crying and crying because she doesn't have it, you know. I'm in the business, I know, you know, and you know, our dreams are crumbling before us, you know. You know, thousands of dollars in lessons and hundreds of hours taking her to the place, and then afterwards I go, Una, and of course I go, no, Una, you're fantastic. I'm hugging her, and she goes, Dad, you would say I was fantastic even if I wasn't fantastic. And I go, you're right. And I go, you're a lot better at logic than you are at ballet. And I say to the audience, like, I didn't say that part. I'm going to save that until she's 16 and she's telling me I'm garbage.
Yeah, great. Okay.
So I'm like trying to fight. So those are 2 different completely isolated bits and thoughts. One's a story from ballet, and one of it was an observation from people asking me about what it's like. And then merging those two is a fun realization. It's like, oh, okay, then that's about 2 or 3 minutes.
Oh, the fun. So merging those two is a fun realization. Can you just clarify what that sentence means? You mean like the glue between those two bits,
yeah,
is a moment of realization that you get to inhabit?
Yeah, and a lot of it is clumping those two bits together, like at the Comedy Cellar in like a casual 10 or 15 minute set, and then improvising in the moment. I didn't say that to her. I'm going to tell her when she's 16, when she tells me I'm garbage. And that's like an improvisation. I'm like, aha, like, okay, that's good. Yeah. 'Cause that makes that a complete thought.
Yes. And do you find that is there a relationship between you, how do you remember those moments when you're live on set? Are you like taping them and listening back?
Yeah, I audio record on my phone all the time. I try to make it as discreet as possible, but yeah.
Yeah. And so you can, but presumably you'll walk away from that night where you have that revelation going, aha,
Yes.
That's a bit where those two will work.
Absolutely, yeah.
I wanted to ask about your... I've got so much, Mike. I've got so many questions on this thing. And you're so part of what I'm so excited about is that you are... Like, you live your life as a comic. You kind of inhabit this place of, I'm the guy that works it out. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, certainly. I've sort of owned that idea that I'm just... Yeah, I'm in process all the time.
Yes. And we haven't even... For those people who are listening and won't see a photo or a video of this... We're in a sort of a different version, a different angle on your studio where you record Working It Out.
That's right.
Which is itself. I kind of looked at it and I saw it. And I was kind of telling a friend, oh my God, Mike's studio. It's like my dream studio. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, accolades and posters and then this incredibly colorful kind of thing. The corkboard with all the different notes. And he said, yeah, but that is curated. And I thought, well, I mean, I guess it is curated. Like there's some thought has gone into, as is my humble studio here, you know, there are some things in there. But I'm interested in that the place you have as a comic whereby you are delivering your persona, which is a curated version of yourself, but then you're also always striving to sort of uncurate it, to make it as real as possible.
Well, it's funny, like the Working It Out podcast came out of, it was a pandemic necessity because we couldn't perform in front of audiences. And so the moment we couldn't perform in front of audiences in America, I started doing these Instagram live with other comedians like John Mulaney and Roy Wood Jr. and others to try to raise money. We called it Tip Your Weight Staff, raise money for clubs across the country. Because the first thing I thought was, oh no, the wait staffs are in big trouble because they're just shutting down everything.
Mike, was that the first thing you thought? That seems staggeringly kind of humble and generous. Okay, fine. we fudged the chronology, and that's an accepted part of the process.
The first was, how do I flee America and go to New Zealand? The second was, how do I hoard water? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, it was about the fourth thing I thought of.
Okay, cool.
So we're raising some money for comedy club staff. And then I was like, people kept asking, where can I get the recordings of these? And of course, I didn't know anything about Instagram Live. So I was like, all right, well, let me just record these as a podcast where I'm working out material with other comedians. Well, 2020, I mean, I know in Britain you had a very different experience of the pandemic, but for 2020, the entire rest of the year was shot. And even a lot of 21, if not all, you know. And so I really wanted to work on material. And I thought, and I also thought, like a lot of people, maybe we'll never perform in front of audiences again. Maybe we'll, you know. And so I just thought, well, let me do a podcast where I work out material, which is the ultimate taboo of comedians, which is sharing material with people before it's done, because then you're essentially showing people the magic trick of the joke, because jokes are really, like, in a certain sense, they are like magic tricks. You know, there's a setup, which is something that we agree, you and I, is true, or me and the audience think is true. And then the punchline, which is like a left turn that goes somewhere that we didn't expect. And if the joke is good enough, the audience really doesn't see it coming. And so, to have a podcast where you're talking about how you arrive at the left turn is kind of taboo. It's like showing people your work. Sure. And the hope is that the joke is good enough that it doesn't matter. You know what I mean? It actually kind of puts my own feet to the fire. And then we got like 100 episodes in. And at that point I was like, well, what I'm finding is people are showing up at the shows, having heard the podcast, and they're saying, I listened to all the episodes and I saw the show and I still enjoyed the show just as much as I would have, and maybe more because I knew how he arrived at it.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. That's what I've been trying to achieve the entire time.
Really? For real?
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
Wow.
I'm a sort of process person. And I remember, funnily enough, I remember talking to In fact, in 2020, I was doing like a kind of online sort of stand-up show, trying to make it work, trying to make stand-up work in Zoom. I was like an early adopter of that kind of thing. And we had Alex Edelman on the show, who's a friend of mine, and I know is apparently a mentee of yours now.
Yeah, I'm presenting a show on Broadway right now. It's incredible, called Just For Us. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fantastic show. I saw that at Edinburgh. And I remember, like, he was, of all the people that appeared on the show, he was pad in hand. Oh, I've written 4 hours of new material, like, you know, mid-2020, because he's got this kind of, you know, just relentless work ethic.
He does. He's been on the podcast 3 times, and he always has new jokes, and he always wants to kick around variations on that. Because I believe, like, the more variations you have on a joke, the more likely it is you're going to arrive at something that's magical.
Yeah. Yeah. And so does it, so when you do those shows, like the work, I mean, do you do like a working it out tour? Is that a thing that's going to happen?
That's what I'm doing in the States this summer. So I'm like in Jersey and Long Island, and I'm doing like little clubs, and I'm just doing completely new. I'm just doing an hour, 70 minutes of new material, completely different from the old man in the pool.
Incredible. And that's because that's, to me, that's a bit like the, stay with me while I try to express the parallel, but it's Penn and Teller doing the cups and balls with the see-through cups.
A little bit. Yeah. Yeah. It's got Penn and Teller DNA in it for sure. I think those guys are great.
Yeah. I just love the idea of revealing it. Like, they know where the joke is going, and then do they, because then you've got the opportunity, as Penn and Teller do, to apparently reveal what's going on, and then you can hide other surprises within it.
That's right. Absolutely. Oh. Yeah.
Wonderful. So we were talking a bit about, yeah, the curated self, which I suppose is a very different way. I mean, the word curated sort of suggests a kind of maybe a kind of a cunning or a deviousness that isn't quite what I mean. But in terms of who you are on stage, in terms of the difference, like the transition between you backstage talking to someone before you walk on to perform The Old Man in the Pool, and then when you walk out, like, what, how much of a transformation is it that takes place? Because you seem to be so in touch with us, and so in touch with your, admit maybe with a fudged chronology, but a real truth about what you're trying to say. You've done so much work on kind of stripping away what is actually going on here. What is the reality of my emotional experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was funny. For my 100th episode, I had Ira Glass on, the host and producer of This American Life, which is a phenomenal podcast that's he's outdone both of us. He's been on for, I think, I want to say 25 years. He's had a radio show that turned podcast and won a Pulitzer and Peabody's and countless things. But he was saying to me, and I think he's not wrong, he goes, you know, you're so anxious in your life and you're so calm on stage. How do you square that? And I say, and he goes, but you're honest about that. You are anxious on stage. You talk about how you're anxious. And you know. And I said, when I'm on stage, I am calm. That's real. Like when I'm on stage, I feel more at peace. And we kind of broke that apart. And I think that the reason is that there's much more of a sense of control and being in charge when I have the microphone and I know how to do it. Whereas everything else in my life, you know, like I've been working on this bit recently about how I go, my wife and I, oh no, here's the beginning of the bit. I go, I think in every marriage or every relationship, ideally there's a person who understands heating and electricity and technical things, and we don't have that, and we're seeking a throuple, and so we're recruiting at local technical colleges, and then I go into this whole thing about how the heat went off in our building and everyone was away for Christmas, and so I had to figure it out. And that's when, basically, it's a long story, but it's when I realized that I do not understand how heat works. And I went to college. I mean, I'm overeducated. I've read quite a bit. It's never come up. And so, like, I feel like when I'm in life, when I'm dealing with the heat or the electric or whatever it is, I'm a mess, or even in interpersonal relations. But when I'm on stage, I feel very calm.
And in just to kind of test that idea, right now you are in a kind of slight, like you're in process. We're talking, you're in a comfortable spot, right? You know, you know what I mean? Like you're talking about the thing in the way that you talk about the thing. And so how calm, this isn't too weird a question.
How calm am I now?
How calm are you now? You seem
I'm pretty calm. Yeah.
So how much of an audience does there need to be for you to achieve that state where you feel calm? Is a recording enough of an audience? Is like an interviewer enough of an audience?
Yeah, I think like honestly, yeah, one person's enough of an audience. I think like I'm fine in a one-on-one situation. I'm fine in performing situations. I think when you start, you know, if you think about your day-to-day life, you're walking down the street and there's a dog walking by, someone's walking their dog to your left, and the dog might sniff you, so to your left, so your neighbor from your right might shout over, "Hey Mike, did you notice the mailbox is jammed?" And so then you're kind of dealing with the dog and the person, and then it starts to rain and you realize you didn't bring an umbrella. And so like you're dealing with multiple stimuli at once, and I feel like therein lies. And then you get to the train and you're wet and the train's not running on time. And so then you have to run up and grab an Uber. The point is, there in life, there's, I think, so much more chaos than in a controlled environment like this. And I'm just not good. I don't think I'm great at the chaos.
Yeah, I don't know. I think some people would, because there is an element of chaos to you working out a new idea, even if you have kind of like branches of the tree that you know you're going to try and swing to next. What is that moment mid-swing but chaos? And I sort of feel like I would love to know. There's a moment in The Old Man in the Pool, which I love. It's a fantastic show. There's a moment when you say that you're talking about your relationship with your parents, and that you're talking about how you never tell your parents that you love them.
Mm.
And I remember thinking, I can't believe that. I didn't,
true.
You know what I mean? True, but I'm sure it is true. But I suppose what it means to me is like, I feel like offstage Mike, I can believe that offstage Mike has never told, or you know, is not in the habit of telling his parents. But the you that's on stage that is delivering the well thought out, carefully nested, structured monologue, suffused with fantastic angles and what have you, I feel like, oh, this guy would be okay with telling his parents that he loved them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I don't mean that to be a criticism. No, I'm just fascinated by the sort of the ambiguity.
You're not wrong. I mean, and to give the full context of that to the audience, like they didn't say they love me growing, you know, my whole life. And I say to the audience, I go, they say, take care. And I go, it's not the same. I go, first of all, it doesn't have the word love in it. Second of all, it's sort of a passive aggressive command. Like, I'm going to need you to do something for me. Take care.
Yeah.
And, but I say, yeah, I don't say I love you to them. And I want to, but it's just, we don't get there. I suppose that's just the dynamic that we're living in. A lot of that, in a way, that's a lot of what Old Man in the Pool is about as a show. And in this sort of circles back to what you're saying about processes, like how do you figure out, how do you figure out what your jokes are about, your stories are about, what are your shows about? At a certain point, I realized this recurring theme in this writing I was doing in the Old Man in the Pool, where I was like, oh, that's actually interesting that my parents and I don't tell each other we love each other, and I'm saying it to an audience, and about half the audience is like, oh my God, I have that too with my parents. And about half the audience is like, oh, I say I love my parents and I tell each other we love each other, but I know what you mean, you know? And so I feel like that's how I arrived at that being something that was worth having an audience, you know, watch 80 minutes of expounding on with stories.
So this is Mike. What are the consistent questions being asked of you, and what consistent questions are you asking of the world? This is the good stuff, right? This is great. I'm so grateful to Mike for coming on. And he's so charming and humble and funny and all of those wonderful things. And I'm just really excited about this. I won't talk to you for long just now, except to briefly spruik that. That's an Australian word. I use it all the time. Do you like it? I enjoy that. That means to stand outside a thing, barking at people through a microphone, getting them to come into your show, which is what I'm going to do now on myself and Mike's behalf. And also, I love the Australian word schmick, which I think is it's to do with something like we would probably say dapper. But I associate the word schmick with a type of person that I would call executive carny. Nonetheless, back to matters. Edinburgh, do not miss Mike's amazing show, The Old Man in the Pool. There are some in the extras to this episode. We'll talk about different elements that were added by in conversation with other comics or different perspectives that Mike took and appreciated. And we'll talk about how to chisel away the possibilities that aren't part of this particular show. There are, I think, one or two spoilers. I think we trod pretty carefully. If you would like to see The Old Man in the Pool completely fresh, maybe save up the extras. But you can see it if you're at the Edinburgh Festival. He's at the Underbelly Bristow Square, which we're both fairly sure is the McEwan Hall, but you know, find out online. August 22nd to the 27th, so the final week of Edinburgh. Go and see The Old Man in the Pool. I know that is selling fast, so please get there quick. September the 12th to October the 7th, Mike is going to be at the Wyndham's Theatre in London. And again, a little birdie tells me that is very close to sold out. So get there. You can find out tickets for both of those shows via babigs.com, and you can follow Mike at babigs on Instagram and Twitter, and possibly even Threads now. Who knows? What fun that is. What larks. My own show, my show Spoilers, which I refer to occasionally in this conversation, is my climate change show. It's my climate crisis anxiety show, and it's cooking. Is it there? I don't know if it's there, but it's there. It's going to be in Edinburgh. I don't know if it's there, but we're 2 weeks away and I don't want it to be overcooked. And I feel like, oh, are we 2 weeks? Are we 3 weeks away? Sorry if I've just scared you. I feel so excited about it. And it's such a kind of manifestation of what I'm trying to do with my comedy that I've really got the kind of, I've really got the sort of a tickle on now where I'm like, oh, here we go. So please come and see that. It won Best Show 2023 at Leicester Comedy Festival. And you can get your tickets at stuartgoldsmith.com/tickets. It's going to be at the Monkey Barrel at, I believe, 3:20. I've been saying that now for ages and I suddenly had a panic and thought, was it 5:20? I'm fairly certain it's 3:20. But it is also now spreadsheet day. So please tweet on Twitter or indeed Threads with the hashtag spreadsheet day. Or if you're on Instagram, try the same hashtag and put your spreadsheets up there for your deeply nerdy spreadsheets of what you're going to see at Edinburgh. The stuff you're going to, I mean, if you've colour coded them, so much the better. If you're in the ComCom Facebook group, that is probably where we will get most of them. Sarah Mahag very kindly started this by tweeting one at me and I thought, my God, we should have done this a month ago and I've been too busy writing and performing. So, yeah, that was an attempt there to let myself off the hook. Guys, I've been too busy writing and performing. So you can see there's a few previews left. I've got some previews coming up. You can find all of those at the link at stuartgoldsmith.com. And that's that. It's exciting times. And let's get back to, oh, there's the extras, of course, from this show. 30 minutes of extras from comedianscomedian.com/insiders or appearing in your insiders feed just now if you are already signed up to support this podcast, which you know and love so much. That's that. So let's get back to the second part of this interview with Mike Birbiglia.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What things do you think are kind of habits of yours? Do you identify particular performative or kind of structural habits of yours? And if you do spot them, are you comfortable with that? Or do you think that part of the journey has to be always discovering a new way to...
I think I had a big discovery maybe 10 years ago, which has to do with conveying the story however which way it comes out. So for example, there's this thing in My Girlfriend's Boyfriend, which I would guess it's on Netflix. In the UK, it might be on something else, a rental or something like that, but it's called My Girlfriend's Boyfriend. Mm-hmm. I performed at the Soho Theater years ago and I act out... I basically say that when I was in seventh grade, I had a crush on this girl and I invited her to go to a carnival with me. And we went on a ride called the Scrambler. and I describe, I don't even think it's probably called a Scrambler in the UK. When I was there, I probably asked what's a similar thing.
I think it's called, it's the Waltzer or so. I think it's called the Waltzer, but yeah, it's clear. I know the one you mean.
Something like that. And I talk about eating I think what in your country they call fairy floss or something like that. It's
candy cotton. Floss.
It's,
sure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Here it's cotton candy. Floss and sugar floss or whatever. And then we eat all this popcorn and peanuts and floss and then we're on the Scrambler together. And of course, you know, to harken back to your point about Chekhov, you know what's going to happen. you got all the food and then you're on this thing that spins you in circles. And in that moment in time, this is probably 15 years ago when I wrote it, I was always so hostile to the idea of acting out what something does, right? I was always that's not who I am. My persona would never act this out. And then with that Scrambler, I just thought, well, there's only one way to convey the motion of this thing and what it feels like to be on this thing. And so I acted it out with my whole body. I was acting out the Scrambler. And I wasn't doing it to kind of win over the audience in some way. I was just doing it to convey the story. And then it ended up being kind of one of my favorite pieces and from the show. And it taught me a thing about myself, which is I don't think that we should be beholden as if you're an autobiographical comedian. It's I don't think you should ever be beholden to what your persona would do, because I think that honestly, that makes the audience rest in their seat and predict what is going to happen or what couldn't happen. And if you allow for going where the story takes you, there's more surprises. And the more surprises there are, the more the audience is invested in what you're saying.
Yes. Yes. There are moments where you almost do the narrative, the theater storytelling equivalent of a one-liner. You know, the moment in the Old Man in the Pool where you say, we don't get to decide the bits of our lives that we remember, which I hope I'm not butchering.
No, I think that's fine.
When you write those, I feel are they the last bits? Are they the last bits in the kind of structure that you go, I'm going to put that one there and now it's a bridge? Do you know what I mean? Or because I feel those things, I'm just interested in how you write them, because they seem to carry so much weight to connect or to clarify the connection between chunks. And they don't have to be funny. In fact, you don't want them to be funny. But you're kind of having to write wisdom, and that's got to be harder than writing a one-liner, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. That's so generous of you to say. It's definitely something that Seth and Joe and I all spend, sometimes Ira, spend an extraordinary amount of time finessing the segues between things, because the equivalent in stand-up is of just straight stand-up that isn't a solo show. It's while we're talking about escalators, there's this thing about escalators. It's you can't really do that in narrative storytelling, that kind of this connects to this because it's essentially the same topic.
Yes, it has. Your segues have to be so much more deft, don't they? Of course.
So your segue essentially has to be something that feels causal or
or even stream of consciousness. A lot of times it's like Seth and I will have long conversations about, okay, there's this part of the conversation which is about swimming, and there's this part of the conversation which is about talking to my doctor about how I have to do cardio because I don't have good lung capacity. And it's like, well, how do those two connect to each other? And so a lot of times it's like, what's the least amount of words that could get you from one to the other? And a lot of it's trial and error, the same way that storytelling is, same way that stand-up is. Stand-up is so much trial and error. What about this segue? What about this segue? And a lot of it's like you reach a point where it's like, oh, okay, it feels right. You do it in front of an audience, and you're like, okay, that feels right. Like they, you can feel it when an audience loses you. You can feel it when an audience goes away. And so we're always on the lookout. We always have our antenna up for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really looking back at my show that I did last night and thinking, yeah, that I can't ignore that one moment when I felt them go away. And I want to fix it. It's like, for me, it's the moment when they realize I really am going to talk about the climate crisis for an hour. Do you know what I mean? I kind of win them. And then maybe 12, 15 minutes in, somewhere around there, there was a set. They were very well lit. I could see their faces.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was like, either I'm doing a number on myself because I'm nervous about the show, or I'm really registering a sense. I've got to trust that instinct, right? I'm registering that they're going, okay. And that's where the work has to be done.
But also, like, if your show is about the climate crisis, like, I feel like it's worth digging into, how does that affect your specific life and your relationship with your child and all that kind of stuff? Because I think that the audience, it's like, you can't dispute when someone gets up on stage and kind of bares their soul and says, like, yeah, this is how this makes me feel, and this is a story that happened that, as a result of this and all the kind of stuff, without wagging your finger and saying, like, we got to do something.
Sure.
But, like, I don't, yeah, like, it's always a challenge to do that.
Yeah. Do you have to learn different phrasings? Like, do you have to learn very slightly different phrasings of the kind of segue moments, those little moments of kind of like what I think of as the wisdom moments? I'm sure you don't call them that, but, like, you know, the short sentence that says a powerful thing, like, in order to know, like with a joke, you would rearrange the words of a one-liner till it worked. Do you have to do the same thing with those? Have you got to learn lots of different versions to go, that's the one?
Definitely. God. A lot of times it's like taking things like that. Like, there's this one where I talk about how I write in my journal every night, because I find that if you write down what you're saddest about or angriest about, you can start to see your own life as a story. And when you see your own life as a story, sometimes you can zoom out and encourage the main character to make better decisions. Mm-hmm. And it's like a moment that's not a laugh, but it's like kind of like, It brings you into my shoes, ideally, so that people are like, oh, yeah, that's why I write my journal, or that's why I do a mental inventory of my life. And, you know, but I tried that out. I tried like 10 versions of that line out until I arrived at it. I think, honestly, I don't remember this exactly, but if I'm being honest, I think I tried out 10 versions that were way more wordy. Yeah. And I kind of just chopped it down. A lot of times I'll write out something as a paragraph, like the fullest idea of it, and be like, okay, chop this word, chop this word, chop this word, chop this word. And then I'll read that as a sentence, and I'll be like, does it still mean the same thing? I know this is so basic, but that's
what I do. No. That's, well, it is, you know, but that's what we might do with a one-liner or with a subject. Yeah. You know, I have a very clear memory of a gig where I thought I had 12 new minutes of material about self-belief, and I walked on stage and something happened in the room and I just said the one-liner version of that. And I was like, well, that's a great line that I'm going to use for years, but what do I do for the other 11 and a half minutes?
Tell you how many times in my career I've had like a 12-minute chunk and I've walked off and gone like, I got a new 12 minutes. And then, like, in the end, it's 90 seconds. Like, by the end of the process, it's 90 seconds.
Alistair Beckett King asks, I would like to know if Mike's focus on narrative with neat callbacks in the final story was in any way influenced by the British Edinburgh Fringe show, or whether it sprung into existence independently, because it's so different to what I think of as the structure of an American special. Now, we've established you haven't been to
I've never
Edinburgh,
been to Scotland,
but,
and
we talked about
I've never
the kind
gone
of
to
British...
Edinburgh. Really wasn't. I mean, honestly, like, it seems like it would have been. It's more of a theatrical play structure. I studied dramatic writing, playwriting, and screenwriting in college, university. I thought I was going to be a screenwriter exclusively. I was convinced of it. And then I got out of college and I realized that no one's looking for those.
Well, even less so than they're looking for stand-up comics.
or playwrights. Yeah. I mean, the amount of ads in the newspaper for playwright needed, there's not many. There's probably a handful ever. It's almost like a thing you'd see in a movie. Playwright wanted. It's like a conceit for a plot point. So then I had been working the door, selling tickets and bringing nachos to people's tables at the Washington, D.C. Improv in college. And I could see people's pay stubs. You know, I was, this person's making $500 to host or $200. I was like, I could live on that. And so I just drove my mom's station wagon around the country to areas of lesser comedy concentration. And I figured out how to be a working stand-up comedian. And then I circled back to writing a play. A solo play, which is what Sleepwalk With Me was. And then what's funny is of course, people now go, oh, you're doing an Edinburgh show. And it's like, oh, it's funny. It's just the nature of we're all studying the same theatrical masters, I think.
Mm. There's a just on Sleepwalk With Me, that moment. There are two moments in particular stand out for me. One is when you're dying on stage, when the character on the stage is dying and the blue light is in your face and there's this incredible faraway look in your eye, which I thought is informed by tough gigs. But I thought also, I mean, it's a really, really powerful kind of moment, particularly to a comic who knows what that feeling is from the inside.
Yeah, that was...
Well, I was just wondering whether that was fun to play or kind of heartrending to play, whether that moment, you know, actually taping it.
That's a lot of credit to our cinematographer, Adam Beckman, who really had a strong vision for that scene and shooting that a certain way, which was, I agree with you. It's painful to watch. It was painful to act, for sure. Because I had to evoke what it does feel like in those moments. For when you start out doing stand-up, I mean, people always say it's like the thing people fear the most is public speaking. And I think because you feel naked. You feel kind of like your soul is naked on stage. It's yourself. It's just you. Mm-hmm. A bunch of strangers judging you.
I think the other aspect of that movie is the kind of the conversation with Marc Maron's character.
Oh,
where he effectively says, like, the secret is just say that. Just say that. Just say the actual thing that's in your head. And your character in the movie undergoes this, you know, beautifully accelerated version of the comedy evolution everyone craves, which is, oh, I just started saying what was on my mind and suddenly everything was fine.
And of course his entire personal life falls apart, but his act is good. That actually is pretty close to life. My pivotal joke in my career was when one time I said to, and it wasn't even a comedian I said this to. I go, you know, my girlfriend at the time, different person that I'm married to, I go, my girlfriend, I think she's, you know, starting to get to the age where she's thinking about having kids, which is, it's sad because we're going to have to break up. And then I go, I've decided I'm not going to have kids until I'm sure nothing else good can happen in my life. And I said it as conversation. And the people were like, well, you should do that on stage. And I was like, well, that would be bad for my relationship. And they were like, well, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. And, I always have to say that
Pick one.
I always have to say that to young comics, when they ask, which is, what do you do about how this affects your relationships? And I go, let me know when you have an answer. I don't know. Cause it never ends. It's not like it ends. I'm 45 now. It's like, I'm still dealing with the same thing. Unfortunately, my wife, Jenny, is a poet and you know, she's contributed to my writing over the years. We did the new one together, and so she gets it. But it doesn't take away from the fact that as a comedian, if you're going close to the bone, you're going close to the bone, and there's other parties who are listening to that and hearing it and have to feel the emotions of that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's a whole other podcast in itself about that, but it's part of the cost, isn't it? It's part of the cost to you, and it's part of the cost to other people who don't get to have all the adulation and the laughs.
It's part of the cost to you. And it's also like, there's one way to look at it, which is that like, there's a famous phrase that is not my phrase, but it's, you're only as sick as your secrets. And it's, and I think it's kind of a beautiful idea. And I think like a lot of times people think they're keeping secrets. They're keeping secrets about like what goes on in their relationship or what goes on in their apartment. And it's like, are we really keeping secrets? I mean, I think in some ways we're all kind of transparent in a certain sense in ways that we don't even realize.
I'm just rolling that around my head for a second. You mean to say that you might think you're concealing something, but it's apparent to everyone around you. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, like I have a joke right now that I'm kicking around. It's not fully formed on stage where I go like, you know, one time my wife said to me like, sometimes I feel like you're not happy. And I'm like, right. That was my status quo before we met. That you know, you knew that. That was what was cool about me. Yeah. You liked that about me. You know what I mean? And like, I feel like that's a joke where it's like, what am I really revealing? Right? Like, it's like, I know, like, if you know my comedy, you know that I have a complicated approach to happiness and ideas and like I'm wearing that on my sleeve, in my opinion. So am I really giving that much away? I don't think so. Someone else might, but I'm not. I don't think I am. And then the end of the joke is I go, I'm happily married. I'm just unhappily alive.
So that was Mike. I will post Amble at you in just a moment. But for now, thank you so much to Mike for coming along. Thanks to Peter and Gary and everyone on his side and his team that helped organise that. And thanks to Sarah Millican for introducing me to Mike in person many, many years ago. And I'm so glad that we finally were able to make that happen. And I'm thrilled to go and see him at Edinburgh. And I'm thrilled to watch him, as they say, taking a bath at the Edinburgh Festival. That has more than one meaning. But I'm looking for. I mean, he's only doing the last week, and he's already a superstar. So, is that really doing the Edinburgh Festival, or is that doing what we call doing a Bo Burnham? So, you can look back to the reviews from that year and the awards to find out what that means. But I can't wait to see Mike up there. Really looking forward to seeing that show again. And you can find out all you need to at bebigs.com. So he's in Edinburgh on August the 22nd to the 27th at Underbelly Bristow Square, and the Wyndham's Theatre in London from September the 12th to October the 7th. Get in quick. There is no excuse to miss this one. It is a masterclass. Thank you to Mike. Thank you to Nathan for producing the show. Thank you so much to Rob Smouten for the music, and Brett Goldstein for simply existing and warming my heart whenever I think of his chiselled features. Thank you to who logged it? Susie Lewis is logging the show at the moment. She's our standby logger. Big love to Moz. And I hope that I will speak to you very soon. I hope I'll see you at Edinburgh. And thank you if you're one of the people who's been coming to the spoilers previews and hanging around afterwards. Oh, big shout out, actually. I did a lovely show at the Hop Inn in Swindon. That's a really good room. Really fun, vibey atmosphere there. And also Little Drop of Poison on, I'm going to say 4th Street, that's popped into my head, in Exeter, which is co-run by Will Adamsdale and a lady called Charlotte, whose name escapes me, and I know so many Charlottes, I'm not going to guess in case it's one of the other Charlottes. But it's such a lovely room. I did a double preview there with Ed Gowan earlier this week. He's going to be up at Edinburgh as well. Really fun, Ken Campbell type, sort of fabulous storytelling type show. I just wanted to, thanks to Tom Parry as well, who came to that one and said very positive and warm things about the shows. And I think I just wanted to shout out that particular venue, because if you're in the southwest and you're sort of, you get further and further away from London, there's a little kind of comedy scene developing there. And it's a really lovely venue, and the staff there really want to make it happen. It's a very lovely indie kind of alternative place in the otherwise rather mainstream Exeter. So that's all that. Right, thank you. That's the lot. I'll post Amble at you in just a second, but thanks for listening. And next week, with luck, an episode I recorded months ago now, which has been paused. Hopefully by next week, it will be unpaused. And if it isn't, we've still got some absolute belters. And I've got Jeffrey Asmus coming up as well next week. And I don't think he's going to cancel, so I'm just bandying his name around without him being in the can. But if you haven't watched his stuff, please watch his stuff. Very, very, very funny. We've got Johnny Pelham coming up. Who else is in the can? Other people. Just other people. Why don't look at the list. Jeff Shaw. Jeff Shaw is in the can as well. And then I think it might be a little Edinburgh break after the paused one. If the paused one unpauses between Jeff and Johnny and Jeffrey, good Lord. Jeff, Johnny and Jeffrey. Ruth Bratt. I knew there was someone else. We have Ruth as well, which is an absolutely sumptuous, twinkling exploration of play and improv and or impro. And it is an absolute splash of sunshine. So that one's coming up soon as well. Right. Goodbye. Post-Amble coming up. Cheerio. So, I haven't decided yet whether I'm committing this post-amble to tape, but I'll just begin it and see how we do. I wanted to... What do I do in these things? I talk to you about what's going on in my little brain, and I often do that whilst going insane in a tiny, airless, lightless room, such as the one I'm in now. I suppose what I wanted to share, which I feel eggy about sharing, but that's the stuff, go towards the resistance. This interview with Mike happened at a time when I had just had a really tough preview the previous night. It wasn't awful, but it was tough, and it was local, and there was sort of people, their parents there that I knew, and it was like a sort of charity fundraiser very near me, and their faces were well lit. And as I've mentioned before, the show is the climate anxiety show. It's funny, man, it's full of jokes, and they liked it, but some people are walking out, and I'm thinking to myself, God, yeah, I'm getting walkouts, but obviously I'm not, I'm a people pleaser, and the type of person, the type of comic I am, is grown around a failure to sufficiently resist this desperation to please people. And I don't mean a failure, I always got to talk about myself as if I'm dog shit on this podcast sometimes, and I have to remember to back myself. It was good and they laughed lots. It is such an odd thing to talk about this weighty and, I think, important subject in a light, friendly kind of a way, which is not friendly, but a light, silly, a stupid kind of a way, but that says stuff. And I've been getting it right, and sometimes it's been going clunk, and it is a fun and fascinating journey. I was feeling a bit bruised. And then something else had happened in life in a wider kind of spectrum, some other work I do. And then something that was a bit tense, like a sort of wake up at 3 and lie there all morning worrying about this thing. And so a few things were happening at once. And I was so nervous about the interview with Mike because I've been trying to get him on forever. He's up there. He's in the canon of, you know, Patton Oswalt and Pete Holmes and people who I dare to not style myself after, but kind of recognise the particular way their brain works and something. You remember the Pete Holmes, I interviewed Pete Holmes live at Just for Laughs. And I had just started getting into the sort of star child, psychonaut kind of reality meandering stuff. And then I listened to his thing and I was like, oh my God, he's nailed it. This is exactly what I'm trying to do. And he's that much further on the path of having made those discoveries. So with Mike, I'm like, oh my God, I'd seen so many of his shows, as you would have heard in this interview. I'd kind of researched and revisited so much of his stuff and just got really worked up about it. And I think I even vague posted in the ComCom group, and to the extent I was like, God, I'm so nervous. And people were saying very supportive things. Thank you if that was you. But I don't like to do that. It's a bit mimsy, isn't it? What I'm saying is I came out of this interview feeling that, you know, it's like watching Daniel Kitson for the first time as a young comic, where you simultaneously feel, my God, these are the possibilities. And at the same time, I should just probably pack it in. I haven't felt that for such a long time. And then after this interview with Mike, I just felt like, oh my God, he's like the A timeline me. Do you know what I mean? He's the process guy. He's digging into it. He's now got a very successful podcast about taking jokes apart and working on them and the process and the creativity and all of this stuff. And he is just so wonderful. I'm kind of in awe of his output. That I fell into, I won't say a black depression, but the confluence of that and then the other factors going on at the time of the show and what have you. I was just at the end of my rope. And why am I telling you this? Because I suppose, what's the value to talking about this? I'm getting it off my chest. I'm confessing it. It's just a confession. And if there is something for you as a newer comic, if you are, if there is something about thinking like, oh God, does that feeling ever go away? And this is maybe not a positive. And it diminishes and then suddenly fucking T-bones you, as they would say. It really, God, do you know what I mean? It was just flailing around. I just thought I wanted to share it with you to get it off my chest. And I thought it was quite funny. You know that thing about, you know, what are the consistent questions that you're asking of the world? And one of mine was, oh God, am I any fucking good at this? I think you need to remain vulnerable, don't you? It's such an odd job. My God. The phases of being a comic as you go through the sort of the fun stage where you're going, I can't come to your party, I'm going to go to a gig, woo! And then the stage years later where you're like, oh, no one invites me to parties outside of comedy because I've binned off all my friends in favour of gigging. And then there's the kind of, now I'm a parent and I've got to try and do a version of my life whilst also serving the needs of other people rather than just gadding around the world having fun. And then there's the whatever this is, you know, I'm approaching 20 years as a comic, and there's a bit where you're like, that's a badge of honour. And then part of you inescapably is thinking, have I really done enough that I've been going for 20 years? Is that, like, is it, am I proud to have been going for 20 years? Or is 20 years also a millstone round my neck? All of that kind of stuff. So all of that stuff bubbled up after this absolutely lovely, just invigorating, exciting, creatively satisfying conversation with a brilliant, brilliant, humble man. So I thought I'd share that. That's how I felt. And I feel better now. It didn't last long. Is that life, comedy or ADHD? Just wait. Just wait. I've said this before. Alan Cochrane years ago said to me that Russell Howard had said to him, and this is, we're talking like 15 years ago plus, apparently the second-hand piece of advice was, the great thing about comedy is no matter how you feel, wait 3 months and you'll feel completely different. Well, I'm pleased to say that after a couple of banger previews recently, that's the other thing I tweeted earlier in the week, when it's going wrong, just write jokes. If you're feeling wobbly, that's the thing. Remember that. You remember Catherine Bohart saying, could it be funny? You can be going through the worst thing in your life and a little voice can go, could this be funny? That combined with, I think of that all the time, and sitting down and writing for four, you know, a chunk for like 3 or 4 hours, and you will be a different human being at the end of it. So I did a bit of that. I've had some cracking shows and I've recovered myself. But I made a note at the time, oh, you feel terrible. You should probably talk about this in a post-humble. So I did. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.